This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, October 29th. This is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Sam Houghton, Jeanette Barnes, Daniel Ackerman, and Eve Zukoff. We'll speak with George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner and Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. CAI's Patrick Flannery and Mike Dean will be talking about all the news from the State House. And we have got something to talk about this week, that's for sure. Late Tuesday into Wednesday, a great walloping storm thumped the region. We saw wind gusts over 90 miles per hour, many of us still without power at home. First, let's find out where we are right now in the recovery effort. CAI Sam Houghton is with us. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
Give us an update. Where are we?
Yeah, so Eversource has made progress. There were about 120,000 without power just on the Cape yesterday, and that's down to about 50,000. Barnstable and Falmouth and Bourne, still some of the most impacted, but not what it was yesterday. Bourne was something like 90% out yesterday, and that's now about 50% of their customers. On the South Coast, about 20,000 are waking up now without their lights. The hardest hit still seems to be Wareham. About 50% there are without power. What's interesting here, I thought the two big South Coast cities, New Bedford, Fall River, seemed to fare okay, at least, you know, compared to the rest of the area. And then the Vineyard, less than 1,000 now are without electricity. That's a big improvement from Wednesday when we were reporting something like 10,000 were without power. And then according to MEMA, or Massachusetts Emergency Management, Nantucket is fully back on. And looking, you know, statewide here, we're at about 160,000 now without power. And that was after close to 500,000 Massachusetts customers without power at kind of the height of the storm. So a big, you know, storm with a big impact. Also looking at schools, sounds like most were actually canceled this today, the third day in a row that schools were out. Sounds like many were without power, some without internet. And then looking briefly at roads, Barnstable County officials are still saying maybe stay off the roads if you can, but they seem to be better than they were at least Wednesday.
Yeah. Well, it's been a long climb up the hill from Wednesday morning, that's for sure. And anyone who's been out and around has seen plenty of power trucks here. They have kind of flooded the zone with crew workers. A storm like this can be an isolating event when the power goes out. So, you know, you're without television or radio, the internet goes down. When we hear public officials saying stay off the streets to let workers clear away trees and other obstacles. But our reporters were out across the region, and we have three of them with us now. I want to ask them each about some of what they heard and saw as they spoke to people and covered the storm's impacts. Let's start with CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
Jeanette, you were out on the South Coast and on the Mid-Cape on Wednesday, right after the storm struck, kind of Tuesday into Wednesday, and the winds were still blowing strong all through Wednesday. Tell us about a couple of the people you spoke to, what you saw.
Sure. Well, I drove down to Marion in the morning to see if there was much damage to boats, and there really wasn't. And I think what we learned throughout the day was this really was more of a tree damage storm than an ocean storm. That was true there as well. I talked to a manager at Barden's Boatyard there in Marion, and she said she felt like they were lucky, no real damage. Driving in and out of there, though, that was where I saw a lot of tree damage. I saw three trees uprooted at Tabor Academy, which is, you know, you drive through there down to get to the waterfront. Then I headed out to Dennis on the Cape. When it was strange driving on Route 6 all along the South Coast, because there are a lot of streetlights in that area of 6, and none of the streetlights were working from Marion all the way to the Sagamore Bridge. In Dennis, I talked to some people heading in and out of Stop and Shop. They were home from work and school, and just kind of making the best of the day. There was a retired culinary teacher I spoke to who said he was getting ready to cook some things out of his fridge that he didn't want to go bad. I talked to a dad from Hyannis with two young children with him. He said they drove into Dennis to eat because a lot of the restaurants they might have gone to in Hyannis had no power. And then later in the day, I stopped in at the Cream and Cone And I talked to a couple there. They were looking toward a chilly night, expecting a chilly night that night because they had no heat at home.
Mm. A lot of people figure out how to cope through this. It's not the first time many Cape and Islanders have been through extended power outages. Yves Zuckoff, I want to ask you the same thing. You were out on the Upper Cape. Tell us about some of the people you spoke with and what you saw.
Yeah, I saw it's even though we were on different parts of the Cape, Jeanette and I saw very similar scenes. I think trees blocking driveways, trees on cars, trees on roads, trees on power lines. You know, tell like a children's book about this. Traffic lights not working a bunch of places. That was seems like pretty uniform across the Cape. Some of the people I talked to that were that stick out in my mind. We're actually trying desperately to get into Betsy's Diner in Falmouth at 10:45. There was an hour-long wait. It was described as just being a zoo inside. I talked to one guy who was there with his two sons, no school. The dad was saying, you know, we wish we were in school today. Like, you know, that changes everything. And they didn't really have anything to do without power. Just looking for an activity that was less dire. But I also talked to a man who lives on Martha's Vineyard, and he said he had been trying to get back to the island since the night before, and still, you know, boats weren't running this week, and said that if the boats weren't going to start running on Wednesday, he would have to drive back to Rockland to stay with his daughter for the night. And he couldn't even get into the diner. He got back into his car and was going to try to find a different warm place to sit and wait for the boats. I talked to a couple people like that. So I know now shelters are open, but even then people were trying to figure out where can I be? Where am I going to go right now?
Well, certainly without power at home, many people went out looking for a place to get some meals, particularly early in this on Wednesday. And even yesterday, as that continued, Daniel Ackerman, CAI reporter for the South Coast. Daniel, you were on the South Coast yesterday. Again, still most places without power. Who did you speak with and what did you see on the second day without power?
Yeah, on the South Coast, too, it seemed like the diners, the few that had power, were kind of refuges. You know, I went to a Mill Pond Diner that's on Route 6 in Wareham, one of the few businesses there that had the lights on, and so they were just kind of slammed during the lunch hour. The staff there were too busy to talk to me, so I just kind of like bounced around from booth to booth in the diner, and you know, the customers were just happy to be somewhere that felt a little like normal. I talked to one couple, Joan and Frank O'Donnell. They said they drove to Wareham to the Mill Pond Diner all the way from their home in Mashpee. They were ordering a couple hamburgers, and they said they were eating out because they were scared to open their own fridge at home. They just didn't want their food to get warm and spoil. So that was kind of a common theme of a lot of the folks eating in the diners there. And, you know, just driving around, like Jeanette said, on Route 6 was something of a scary situation because all of the stoplights were not functioning. And, you know, that's a busy four-lane road. Crosses other four-lane roads, and cars were just kind of like inching through the intersection trying to avoid collision. So, you know, I didn't see any crashes, but it also didn't feel super safe. So as wild as it sounds, it made me appreciate red lights a little bit.
You also swung by the Home Depot there and found a busy scene.
Yeah, so Home Depot, they had a generator, so they were also one of the few places with the lights on. And I talked with the manager there, Jason Curtis, who told me that the hot ticket items that day were space heaters, gas cans, extension cords, and generators. So as, you know, an emergency supply provider, they were actually getting new shipments of generators into the store throughout the day. But Curtis said it still was not enough to meet demand. They just couldn't keep those things on the shelf. So people were definitely preparing to settle in for a long stretch without power, and probably for good reason. As of this hour, there's still just over half of customers in Wareham don't have power.
The effort by Eversource, the utility, to restore power has been on a very large scale. Jeanette, you were at a press conference yesterday where they were kind of briefing folks on what their approach is and what their expectations should be. Tell us what you heard. What was this like?
Yeah, it was held in the parking lot of the Falmouth Mall, which is one of the places where Eversource is holding a lot of the electrical supplies those crews need. So there are rows of transformers out there in the parking lot, pallets full of other supplies. I saw these gray bars that looked kind of like metal, these long bars, but they weren't metal. And what I learned is that those are now the crossbars that are used at the top of telephone poles. And they're gray because they're a composite material now, not wood. But the as far as the press conference, the Eversource CEO, Joe Nolan, he talked to reporters. He said, there are thousands of line workers here from various states and Canada. They're sleeping in hotels. They actually didn't really have enough room. So Joint Base Cape Cod has opened up to help feed them and house some of them as well. And in terms of the power, like Sam said earlier, he said 98% of customers should have power by Saturday night, if not earlier.
They said they were putting out, what, 30,000 meals to feed these line workers every day?
That day, he said, yeah. I guess each day while they're here, 30,000 meals, yeah. That's, you know, includes three meals a day.
Schools have been closed during this time, which is a little bit of an extra stress for many parents. Many people have had their work closed, too, without power. People are coping, trying to pass the time. It hasn't been the loveliest weather, so being outside isn't the most attractive option right now. Jeanette, yesterday you checked in on one location where people seemed naturally to gather. Tell us about this.
Yes, I went to the Falmouth Library, to the main library. The assistant director there, Jennifer Woodward, she told me that two of the three power lines coming into the library were working. So they moved some lamps around and things to make as many lighted reading areas as possible. The library was certainly busy. People came in for all the usual things, right, to keep warm, to charge their phones, tablets, use the Wi-Fi. I did meet one woman who said that she was trying to get connected to the Wi-Fi in the basement of the library for her work, and she couldn't get on. And she had been told that it was just getting overloaded there at the library from so many people being on the Wi-Fi. But I also met, and this was fun, I met a CAI listener, Natalie Andrews, who was there. She had three young sons with her. And by the way, she also had her Eton emergency radio, one of our supporter thank you gifts, with her. But she and one of her sons both talked about some of the fun things they've been doing as a family to weather the storm, having a fire, roasting marshmallows, and reading aloud and things like that.
It's probably a good time to pull out that Eton emergency hand crank radio if you've got it in the back of your cupboard. A big concern with storms like this, a punishing nor'easter, can be coastal erosion. We've seen that before. Eve Zuckoff, it turns out, despite those really high winds, coastal erosion wasn't as big of an issue this time around. Let's talk a little bit about why. What can you tell us about what happened that way?
Yeah, it's really interesting. What kind of explains the limited damage so far that we've seen along the coast? I mean, to be clear, some areas like on Salt Marsh Road and Sandwich, they had a lot of erosion on the dune, but then like the Outer Cape seems to have little erosion right now and on early look. And what explains that is that even though the storm surge was about 3.5 feet, and obviously it was a big storm, it happened at what's called a neap tide. It happened at a low astronomical tide. So while the storm surge did actually coincide with high tide, which is usually a recipe for disaster, this high tide was a really low one. Had this storm happened last Wednesday or next Wednesday, we would have lost another foot and a half of water just as a starting place. So it would have been a lot worse. We would have been having a much different conversation right now.
I know you also talked to folks at the Cape Cod National Seashore. I imagine they have a good sense of how the Outer Cape looks. What did they tell you about the damage there?
Yeah, so what they've seen so far is that one of their construction trailers at Nauset Light Beach was flipped over on its side. That was threatening the walking path down to the beach. At Highland Light, the covering and scaffolding scaffolding itself was torn. So that area is closed off. But the good news is that the Marconi Stairs survived the storm. While they have not yet been able to access all the beaches because the waves were still really just rowdy, I guess, on Thursday afternoon, the folks at the National Seashore haven't gotten significant reports of erosion damage. So they're pretty hopeful that they got through this relatively unscathed.
Now, on Wednesday, so the storm came in Tuesday night and kept blowing all through Wednesday. And Wednesday afternoon, the high tide came around 4 o'clock. There were a lot of concerns about Sandwich, and especially the houses along Sandwich there facing that high tide with all that northeast wind coming in. You went out there to take a look at that that day. Tell us what you saw then and what happened with those houses.
Yeah, to get a sense, I went to Salt Marsh Road, which is an area that regularly floods. So I was prepared for it to become impassable at high tide. So I went about an hour before high tide onto one property with a contractor who took me there. And when we went up on top of this dune where the homes sit, all of a sudden we were just met with 40, maybe 50 mile an hour winds. We saw 10, 20 foot waves, and the beach stairs for, you know, the dozens of houses on this road were already getting swallowed up, just warped and split and destroyed on this road. 8 to 10 feet of the dune was lost in the night before I talked to one owner who was there that night, and he said on his second story window on his house, he was feeling the salt water come up and splash it. And he said he and his wife have lived in this house since the 1980s. They have never seen that before. The salt water was also hitting some of the power lines, and salt is a conductor, so it was sparking, which was really scary. They actually evacuated before high tide. Honestly, when I was standing out on the back deck of this home, watching the stairs of this home get swept and eaten away, it was scary. Like, I was trying to talk to this contractor, and the wind was sucking the air out of my mouth. But this contractor is much braver than I am, and he took some really incredible photos that we have on our website. So we have information on our website, but we also have some photos that I think help tell the story of this storm in a way that not everyone got to see.
And ultimately, there was no house damage in the kind of undermining way that we've seen previously out there along Sandwich.
Yeah, thankfully, the underpinnings of these houses remained strong. These stairs go increasingly like every year, but no house was swept into the sea in Sandwich, and it sounds like anywhere. So that's a good thing.
We have been talking to CAI reporters Sam Houghton, Jeanette Barnes, Eve Zuckoff, and Daniel Ackerman. Thank you all for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. Power outages and school cancellations. It's almost like a winter blizzard, only we didn't get the snow. George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us to tell us how the island fared in all of this and more. Hi, George.
Good morning, Steve, and thank goodness there wasn't any snow because it's been cold enough.
That's true, but my kids home from school, my son, I think he would have enjoyed a little snow to play with, but I'm with you. Tell us how the island fared through all of this.
Oh, it really packed a wallop. As our front page of our print edition says, walloped. And you really can't put it any other way. It hit in all different kinds of ways. Boats knocked off moorings. There was some flooding, although not as much as we typically see, but just trees down everywhere. Up island, early on, our reporter Rich Salzberg took a ride on some of the roads out there, like North Road and South Road and Middle Road, and he described it to me as like being on a slalom course when you're skiing, just weaving in and out of trees, very precarious. But Rich has been at it for a long time, and he knows how to keep himself safe and to get the news out. He did a tremendous job during all this, as our entire staff did, you know, working in some pretty precarious situations and dealing with power outages themselves and no internet. And our print edition is a day late. I wanted to mention that this morning so folks on the island can look to their mailboxes today to see the print edition of the paper, and we appreciate their patience on that.
But power outages largely taken care of on the island, or a good percentage of them by now, Friday
good
morning?
Percentage, but there's still about 2,000 people on the island affected by power outages. That's down from the day before when there were 3,292. Obviously, much better than the early stages, but there are still people, you know, dealing with this to the point where a couple of warming centers had been opened on the island. Aquinnah was one of the places. They at one point 100% of the town had no electricity, so they did open up a warming place there, and some people took advantage of that. Now down to just 10 customers there without electricity, so much better situation up island this morning than it had been. But we're still hearing from people a little bit frustrated that they can't get straight answers and that the power may be out until late in the day on Saturday, which, as you know, another
storm may be coming our way.
Well,
so, not the same dimension of storm, but still more wind
absolutely.
And rain. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, George, we have just a couple of minutes here. I want to ask you about a non-storm story. It's kind of a follow-up to a story we've talked about a number of times. It's about an incident at a Chilmark day camp where two young boys, both white, put a tent strap around the neck of a third boy who was black. There's been a settlement here. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so a lawsuit was filed this week by the parents of the boy who was harmed in the incident, and it was quickly settled almost within a day or so of being filed. It's a $45,000 settlement. Much of that money will go into a fund for the boy, you know, and obviously the lawyers always get a little cut of it. But this brings to an end the legal part of the situation. Still a lot of people on the island hoping that that changes are going to be made at the camp, and the camp has promised those changes in a plan that they unveiled recently. So, you know, maybe an ending to this part of this story, but something that people will be watching moving forward, hoping that, you know, these types of situations won't happen again at the camp.
It's George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks.
Thanks, Steve. Take care.
The Cape Cod Chronicle covers Chatham, Harwich, and Orleans, and Tim Wood of the Chronicle joins us with an update from there. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, how did you all fare, and what's the prognosis?
Well, pretty much like the rest of the Cape, Chatham, Harwich, and Orleans suffered extensive damage to trees, power lines down. We had 69-mile-per-hour wind gusts here in Chatham and Orleans. It knocked boats off their moorings. There was fortunately no major damage. There was some erosion to the shoreline, but fortunately, again, the tides weren't super high, other than some washovers of the outer beach. Crews have been in town, as in the rest of the area, for a couple of days now. They've knocked the amount of power out. Down quite a bit initially at the height of the storm, sort of on Wednesday. Orleans was leading the pack with 91% of the town out. They've got that down today to 33%, but still in Chatham, 18% of residents are without power. Harwich is down to just 3.9%, so that's pretty good progress. Mm. Crews made pretty good headway in all three towns, getting the trees out of the roads and things cleared up. But even as early as yesterday, there were still areas where trees were blocking the road. It was just kind of a mess. It's looking better now. Monomoy is back at school. They were off for 2 days because of the power situation. Through the rest of the day today, Orleans and Chatham will have warming centers and charging stations open at the Orleans Town Hall and the Chatham Community Center for any folks who still don't have power and could use a little warming up or charge their phones or computers or whatever.
Let's talk about another story in the paper this week. There's a move afoot to put the Chatham Airport under the direct control of the Select Board. This comes after some complaints that the airport oversight about the airport oversight, which I guess that board is appointed by the Select Board, but people feeling like it hasn't been responsive enough to some of the concerns of the community. Is that right?
That's pretty much it. A lot of critics of the commission feel, going back to skydiving when it started here a decade ago, that the airport commission just hasn't been listening to residents. And that continued as the commission updated the airport's master plan. Residents, a number of people feel that their concerns are being ignored by the commission. Now, the Chatham is currently going through a charter review process, and the possibility of shifting the authority over the airport from the commission to the select board came up during discussions there. And it seemed to strike a nerve both among the select board, who really don't want to see that happen, and some residents who are pushing for it. Basically, under state law, the airport commission has total authority over the airport, even though they are appointed by the select board. Town council in Chatham has said that it would be permissible for the charter to name the select board as the airport commission, just as the select board is now the water and sewer commission. The one caveat on that is that the state law requires that there be at least one member of the airport commission who has aeronautical experience. Theoretically, that'd have to be the case with the select board as well if they were the airport commission. So that's kind of a stumbling block. But right now, this is just a concept. The Charter Review Committee is scheduled to discuss it further depth on November 2nd. And actually, this coming Tuesday, the select board will take up the issue, and they're expected to oppose it. We'll be watching that and report on it in next week's paper.
And the airport has just been, along with the skydiving, as you say, they've got this master plan that they've been working on that's, brought out a lot of concern, right, about what it's calling for?
Yeah, the master plan, the biggest controversy there is that it's proposing a different method for planes to land during inclement weather. Right now, the planes have to circle, and they can only land if they can have visibility of the airport at 600 feet or so. This new plan would use instrument landing techniques and have planes come in at more of a straight angle. Critics say that this is going to cause more airplanes to land during iffy weather, and they'll be flying lower over residential areas. And other aspects of the plan, critics feel that will expand the airport to larger and more noisy planes, jets and things like that. Even though there's no physical expansion of the airport planned, there's a lot of concern that this master plan is going to lead to more commercialization of the airport and more traffic that people in the airport vicinity don't really want to see.
It is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
Provincetown was 100% without power following the storm this week, according to the utility Eversource, and Truro wasn't much better. That's as a line that brings power to the Outer Cape failed. Marianne Bragg of the Provincetown Banner has an update for us. Hi, Marianne.
Hey, Steve.
Tell us about what the situation was like this week with the power going out and the storm itself as it came down upon the Outer Cape.
Well, let's see. Definitely the wind was a huge factor. And there were the official report from the National Weather Service at the Provincetown Airport was the biggest gust was 61 miles per hour. But unofficial reports were had it up to, I think it was like 83 miles per hour around there in Truro and Wellesley. And definitely, I think people were feeling their houses shaking. But by Wednesday, really the entire town of Provincetown, as you said, was completely out of power. Thank goodness it wasn't, really cold weather.
Mm-hmm.
Same with, Truro and Wellesley. But by yesterday, the power was back on pretty much for, all of Provincetown. I looked, checked this morning, and it's like 15 properties are still without power right now in Provincetown. Truro's doing pretty well, less than 10% are still without power. But Wellesley was really, they were still kind of suffering in the power department yesterday. And particularly, there were, Eversource trucks out working and reports of trees down. But one of the things out here, in Truro and Wellesley is that, many, most properties have private wells, which require electricity for the pump. So this kind of that issue of getting fresh water, and the Wellfleet Fire Department was providing fresh water and then also, I guess, water as well. So that was one of the issues. And there's a lot of generators out here now. So you people, you know, turning their generators on, turning them off, kind of loud, the kind of loud noise in all the neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. But now it looks like, as you say, Provincetown and Truro are well on the way to restoration, and Wellfleet is coming along more slowly.
Right. They were this morning at 25% of the properties were still without power in Wellfleet. So it's like 1,200. So that's where they stand for the moment. And I think when we spoke to Select Board member Janet Reinhart, and she kind of described it as the properties along Route 6, you know, do have power, but the properties that are, you know, deeper in the woods or down smaller roads, including her own, were without power. And so she was kind of facing the reality that potentially she wouldn't get power back till like 6 o'clock on Saturday, which she was, you know, not really that happy about. But she also referred to her generator that she kind of was managing to kind of keep everything going for the moment.
Marianne, let me ask you about another story. Provincetown figured prominently in a national report out recently. It was not one of those reports where you want to rank highly, unfortunately. Tell us about this report and what it says.
Right. This was there's an organization called First Street Foundation. So they're a nonprofit. They're based in Brooklyn. And their mission is to provide kind of accessible information about, for one thing, flood risk. And in fact, they have, you know, a special website called floodfactor.com where you can just easily, any regular old person can just go there, put in your zip code and get, you know, kind of a comprehensive sense of, you know, what the flood risk is right there in your town. So on October 11th, they released a new report that's really, it's considered kind of, I think, the first nationwide assessment of flooding vulnerability. It's called Infrastructure on the Brink. And in Massachusetts, so they went through all the states, you know, in the country, but in Massachusetts, they had their top 10 communities that right now are at greatest flood risk or have the greatest flood vulnerability. And the top one was Hull, second was Lawrence, third was Adams, and then the fourth was Provincetown. Mm. And this assessment, it looks at kind of also, you know, homes, businesses, roads, but it also looks at what they call critical infrastructure, like medical facilities, and also like social facilities, what they categorize as social, like government, historic buildings, churches.
Let me ask. Let me jump in and ask you. It can't be a surprise to anybody there or any of us that Provincetown ranks so highly as at flood risk. What is the response? What have you heard? What kind of response have you heard from the town about what this suggests, particularly around, as you say, critical infrastructure as well?
Well, let's see. So, the response was kind of mixed, I would say. There is a sense of optimism that people do, you know, I think when they're here, they already do know what the flood risk is, and that in certain sectors, such as real estate sales, that those, you know, aren't really showing any signs of diminishing. From a public works perspective, the director, he pointed to what you would call local comprehensive planning, but now includes factors such, you know, most importantly about climate change. And that's really the basis of this big report, is the fact about the changing environment. So they reported to basically kind of, you know, much more attuned planning. And also the other emergency manager coordinator, he pointed also to capital projects that the town is undertaking to kind of buffer the town from what is certainly, as you said, a known factor of risk, of flooding risk.
It's Marianne Bragg of the Provincetown Banner. Marianne, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Josh Bolling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Nantucket may feel a little left out of it with all the dire storm coverage this week. Josh Bolling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror joins us to explain why that's a good thing. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, I don't understand. No days-long power outages, no kids not going to school. It seems like Nantucket usually catches the worst end of passing storms, but not this one. Though
Definitely not this one.
You weren't scot-free, though. Yeah, yeah.
You know, we catch quite a bit of powerful storms that come over the area. We really don't get too many power outages. We haven't for years. Between the undersea cable and the way a lot of the power lines out here are buried and the others are really kept away from trees for the most part, the power crews out here do a great job. When the rest of the region tends to lose power, Nantucket doesn't. And if it does, it's only for a limited amount of time. We had about 1,700 households without power overnight between Tuesday and Wednesday, but they were brief, and by midday Wednesday, there were only about 5 to 10 customers that still didn't have power. So we lucked out there. But nonetheless, it was a powerful storm. A lot of trees got uprooted. A number of boats, including a pretty big sailboat, were beached, and we were cut off a little bit, at least travel-wise, from the mainland. All ferry service on Wednesday, a good chunk of Tuesday, and even into Thursday morning were canceled. But all in all, we did pretty well. The winds were strong, among the loudest I've ever heard, and I've been out here for about 25 years. Officially, the airport reported a 70-mile-an-hour gust, but we have some unofficial reports from our spotters around the island of up to an 84-mile-an-hour gust and a couple others over 80. But you know, as I said before, the biggest damage was to trees, and we haven't seen too much of that all that recently. It could be, you know, because it was a relatively early nor'easter and the leaves were still on, but dozens around the island were uprooted, including a massive American elm downtown, which the town arborist said was most likely weakened by disease. But in a stroke of very good luck, this really, really tall tree came down completely in the street, causing no damage to any of the buildings on all sides, really. And it took Public Works crews a couple hours to cart that one tree away. Our harbor master, Sheila Lucy, is still assessing the damage down on the waterfront. She says there has been some pretty significant damage to the town pier's dinghy docks and floating docks. She's still waiting for a full report on that, but she's not that optimistic. Flooding, as it always seems to be in these recent years due to climate change, was an issue a little bit on Wednesday during high tide. Easy Street, which leads to the Steamship Authority Terminal, was closed when the water reached about curb height. And other neighborhoods down near the downtown waterfront that typically see high water during storms also flooded. But again, all in all, Nantucket fared pretty well. Things were almost immediately back to normal on Thursday, and even Wednesday it was windy, but you know, everything was operating as usual.
Hey, it's a big weekend coming up for local sports enthusiasts on Nantucket and on Martha's Vineyard, the Island Cup.
The Allen Cup is coming up. It actually has been postponed due to the next storm that's on the way. It's been postponed from Saturday to Sunday, so only a 24-hour delay. And it's our homecoming weekend as well, not just the football team, but four other teams will also be playing teams from the Vineyard, so it's going to be a pretty busy Sunday. On paper, at least, it looks like the Allen Cup is Nantucket's to lose. Nantucket's 4-2 coming into the game, coming off a really big triple overtime win over Sandwich. And the Vineyard's just 1-5 this year. But as Vito Capizzo, who was Nantucket's late legendary football coach, used to say, it doesn't matter what the records of either team are, and you can throw the standings out the window when the Allen Cup happens, because anything is possible. And that game's at 2 o'clock on Sunday. A number of other games before that. The homecoming pep rallies tonight, and the homecoming parade is also Sunday before the game.
Just let me ask you about one other story in the paper. A beloved Nantucket institution is preparing to start back up again. This is out at the Matticat Landfill.
Yes, the Take It or Leave It out at the Matticat Landfill, where for generations people have been able to drop off used unwanted goods, and other people will swing by and take a look at them and pick them back up, is set to reopen on November 10th. It's going to be a little bit different than most people can expect, a little more orderly. There's always been some concerns over the years about the piling up of goods and some unruly behavior every once in a while, but there'll be a number of attendants on hand, and there'll be two separate areas, one to drop off, one to pick up. Take it or leave it was closed, not because of sort of that unruly behavior, but because of COVID-19 for the last year and a half or so. But it gave town officials some time to rethink it. It's sort of an island tradition. People have apocryphal stories of going out there and finding real treasures, whether it's art or china or some other things. Even they said they've picked up books from there that had money secreted between the pages. But it's a fun thing to go out and do, and it's a real boost to some people actually who may need some clothing or some other items that they can't necessarily afford or find on Nantucket. And it's a way to really recycle at the grassroots level.
It's Josh Bowling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks.
Thank you.
At the State House, lawmakers are sparring over how to redraw the districting map ahead of the next election. Patrick Flannery spoke with CAI State House correspondent Mike Dean about this and more news from Beacon Hill. Here's the conversation.
Let's talk about redistricting, if we could. Tell us about the vote, why this matters, and what this means for representation from here on out.
The Senate passed their redistricting bill. The House passed theirs the week before. And this is the chamber's kind of redrawing the political maps to reflect the census results from 2020. So precincts change, town lines kind of go in and out of different districts, things like that. And this is really the legislature choosing their own, what they want those chambers to look like and reflect. So a major goal in both chambers was to create more majority-minority districts. These are districts that, of course, would have a majority non-white voting population, and more importantly, would be more likely to send a person of color to Beacon Hill to serve in either the House or the Senate. So the Senate yesterday ended up with six majority-minority districts. That's up from just three in the previous decade's maps. They're going to be in Lawrence, Brockton, and the new one in kind of Boston-Cambridge area, in addition to three that already existed. And so that's really seen as something very important going forward, because the Senate, even more so than the House, is 95% white, which is not reflective of the Commonwealth as a whole.
Governor Baker, he got a bit testy in an interview this week regarding why he hasn't yet announced whether he'll run for another term.
Yeah, I mean, I think you get testy, too, if everyone asked you every day, are you going to run for a third term? Are you going to run for a third term?
Fair enough.
You know, being on the line with talk show hosts like he was the other day, it's something that comes with the job, certainly. He said he's going to decide sometime in the fall. It's definitely in the fall. We're waiting to hear from other candidates as well. And that really is the big political question right now. Does Baker go for a third term, or is it going to be an open race next year in 2020? Because a lot of the decisions that Baker's making now around the pandemic, around reopening, around vaccines and mandates are what could definitely shape both the general election next year in November and more immediately any kind of Republican primary that Baker has to get over before he gets to that general election.
We're on the cusp of the COVID vaccine arriving to the state for children. And this sort of intersects with the governor saying the vaccine is safe to get, but he wished he knew how to make the sale to people holding out. And we're talking about the public workers, thousands who have just refused to get it. I mean, what are the repercussions here now that we're going into the fall and the pediatric vaccine is going to be upon us as well?
Yeah, well, Baker's saying that all of the appeals, all of the different exemption requests are going through the state's central HR, human resources system, at the executive level. So if there's someone who will say works for the Department of Corrections, those exemptions and applications would go through DOC, but then get kicked up to basically Baker himself and Baker's people at the State House. So this is going to be a slow process. I don't think Baker wants to fire anybody over this, at least according to him. And he definitely wants to hear everybody out. That's certainly what he's been saying over and over again. But, suspensions are definitely, in the mix already. We're seeing more and more. And sooner rather than later, the governor's going to have to separate, those who are of good faith looking for exemptions and those who are simply refusing the order.
That is CAI State House correspondent Mike Dean speaking with Morning Edition host Patrick Flannery. You're listening to the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. This week, scientists announced that critically endangered right whales are suffering a further population decline. A new population estimate says just 336 North Atlantic right whales remain. CAI's Eve Zuckoff returns to us after joining us in the beginning of the program. Hi, Eve.
Hi again, Steve.
336 whales left. Put that in context for us. It's obviously not good, but how bad is it?
Well, it's the lowest population estimate for this critically endangered species in nearly 20 years. And that's according to the North Atlantic Right Whale Consortium, which announced the news ahead of its annual meeting this week. And for the population, it's an 8% decline in a single year. The last estimate was 366 whales. So it's a very serious problem that there are all kinds of measures to protect the whales, from entanglements in fishing gear and collisions with boats that are drafted over years and executed by states and the federal government and Canada's federal government. But this decline says something is absolutely not working here.
I guess a question that comes to mind is that with this number of whales left, 336, can this whale species be saved?
Yes, it's actually an unequivocal yes from the scientists who study them, because after whaling in like the early hundreds of years ago, after whaling decimated the population, some say maybe just 60 were alive. And then in 2011, because of some helpful conservation measures, the population hit nearly 500. So these whales are incredible in terms of their resilience, but they can't rebound if they don't have safe habitats and low stress lives where they're not constantly fighting off infections from non-fatal entanglements, and they aren't breeding and they aren't getting pregnant. And so really the measures to save them have to be happening now, because in 20 years, scientists say they are on track to be functionally extinct. Like maybe there are 20 or 50 males left in the population, so they're not technically wiped off the earth, but there's no future for the species at that point.
So between then and now is that between now and the 20-year window they're looking at is when so much has to happen. You mentioned that there was this annual meeting of the big right whale researchers across North America this week. You attended some of that. What were the main takeaways from there?
Yeah, well, obviously this population number hung over every conversation for the rest of the conference, like in conversations about right whales and offshore wind. I mean, there are just so many questions about how the two will interact. Will the whale's habitat be disturbed by offshore wind farms? Will the distribution of their food change? Will the noise cause even more toxic stress? Or in conversations about where regulations go next? I mean, on the table are fishing closures, limited speed zones, new fishing gear that breaks more easily, new fishing gear that doesn't use ropes almost at all. But what combination of those things will actually save these whales that will be fair to fishermen isn't clear. It's just not clear, but there isn't any time left to waste because both parties are suffering the way things are now.
Even in the last couple of weeks, we've seen some of the rules enacted in order to save the whales being held up in court as fishermen have protested.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a group of lobstermen up in Maine who have actually had some success so far as they've challenged these rules for being really unfair, for making it impossible for them to maintain their livelihoods. And there are so many legal challenges going on right now, it can be hard to keep them all straight. Mm. But it's interesting to watch, you know, the element that we don't know is how will a judge at some point say, we've got to protect fishermen, we've got to protect the whales. This is one of those stories that I don't know where it begins and ends right now.
That is CAI's environment reporter, Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
And that's our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from Eve Zuckoff and from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Sam Houghton and Daniel Ackerman. We also spoke with George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner, Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and we heard from CAI's Patrick Flannery and Mike Dean talking about all the news from the Statehouse. Big thanks to Dan Treidel for making the program work. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.